New tonight at 11, Montgomery County Police are looking for who is responsible for yet another anti-Semitic act of vandalism in our region. This time it happened at Walt Whitman High School in Bethesda. The message, Jews not welcome, was spray painted on a sign just days after the school had a lesson trying to confront anti-Semitism.
The words Jews not welcome have been scrubbed off this sign at Walt Whitman High School. But the message still lingers for Jewish students like Rachel Barrel.
It was a whole bunch of Whitman kids pooled together. And, you know, we all opened our phones at the same time and you could hear kids just saying, oh, my God, like, check your emails, because everyone was just in shock of what happened.
Montgomery County Police say the anti-Semitic graffiti was found this morning, just 3 days after the school led a lesson on confronting anti-Semitism.
It's time that we open everyone's eyes about the fact that Whitman is not this accepting, blissful place that everybody thinks it is. We have real problems with anti-Semitism, racism, xenophobia in general. Seeing people like Kanye West, they're saying all of this anti-Semitic stuff, but the root of anti-Semitism, modern day anti-Semitism obviously, is Holocaust denial.
Rachel says that that same rhetoric is trickling down among her classmates. That's why the student group Jews for Change are staging a walkout on Thursday, demanding their concerns about anti-Semitism be addressed.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Courageous Conversations about our schools. This is your host, Ken Fiedernick, and today I will be speaking with several guests about an extraordinarily serious problem in America, one that has existed for many years and in many forms, but is increasingly prevalent in America's schools. The problem is anti-Semitism, hateful acts against Jewish people. In 2022, the Anti-Defamation League recorded 3,697 cases of anti-Semitism. That was a 36% increase over the previous year. The ADL also reported a 50% increase in cases reported in K-12 schools. Now, theories abound that attempt to explain the sharp rise of this form of bigotry, but many of the experts who study hate believe it is in part a symptom of America's growing polarization and the increasingly toxic politics that we've all witnessed in recent years. It's certainly not helped that a number of public figures, like Kanye West, or Ye as he wants people to call him now, have unapologetically and repeatedly voiced anti-Semitic rhetoric. Today, we will be focusing on the impact this form of hatred has on students, their families, their schools, and communities. We will also be discussing two critically important questions. What can schools do to prevent anti-Semitism? And what should schools do when it happens? My guests include two high school students who have witnessed anti-Semitic acts at their schools. And we will also hear from parents with students in the same school district. And we will hear from a university professor who has spent years developing programs that cultivate the kind of character and dispositions we hope to see in all of our students, the kind of character that would find anti-Semitism abhorrent. So let's meet our guest. Rachel, let's start with you.
Hi, my name is Rachel Barrel. I'm the president and founder of Jews for Change, which is a national student-led organization working to fight anti-Semitism in school by talking to school administrators across the country and along with our wonderful lawmakers in this country.
Great, Rachel. Thank you. Eliana, introduce yourself, please, and tell us where you go to school. I think you're at the same school as Rachel.
Hi, I'm Eliana Joftis. I'm the president of the Jewish Student Union at Whitman in Montgomery County. So the Jewish Student Union is primarily a club that just helps Jewish students at a very large high school have a place where they feel connected to their community. We do holiday celebrations, but we also do activism work and spreading awareness about issues in our community, our country, and our world, and different outreach programs, working with different local organizations.
And Eliana, I know you have to leave before this is over, so we're going to come back to you in a moment and have you talk about some of the things that have occurred at your school in just a second. But let's come to you, Nicole, next. Tell our audience about you.
So I'm Nicole, and I am the parent of two elementary school students. They go to a Montgomery County public school, and I live in Rockville, Maryland.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. Rebecca, welcome to this podcast. Tell our audience about you and your connection to this particular topic.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm Rebecca Chagalis, and I'm in Northern Virginia. And I'm a former history teacher, and now I run United Against Anti-Semitism, which is an advocacy organization that fights anti-Semitism in K-12 schools, which is how I got to know some of the people on this call, actually.
Great. Thank you for that. And finally, Dr. Elias, I'd love for you to introduce yourself and tell our audience about your work.
I'm Maurice Elias. I'm a professor of psychology at Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I'm also a contributing faculty member in Jewish studies, and I direct the Social, Emotional, and Character Development Lab, which is designed to promote positive development in schools.
Great, great. And we're going to come back to you and have you say more about that in just a moment. But I want to start by asking our students to describe the anti-Semitic acts that have occurred recently at your high school in Montgomery County, Maryland. And because, Eliana, you have to go in just a few minutes, can you talk about what you have observed and what effect those anti-Semitic acts had on you?
Yeah, so the three most prominent things that have happened that have been the most public incidents of anti-Semitism at Whitman was a anti-Semitic graffiti in December. A vandal spray painted the words "Jews not welcome" on our school sign. The second big thing that happened was two students said very, very horrific things about Jewish students that they were on a debate team with. The third thing was they've been finding swastikas all over Montgomery County public schools, but they had found one in like a lab desk in our school classroom were the three things that came to mind for me. And Rachel can probably talk about other things.
I'm going to turn to you, Rachel. And I want to just begin by, I don't think you need to add to what Eliana said about what occurred, unless there's some things that you want to clarify or add to that.
Yeah.
But then, yeah.
I definitely, specifically with like the debate incident, the school didn't publicize almost anything about the debate team incident, which was also a huge point of controversy. They didn't really tell anyone what happened. But I've spoken to the two witnesses that were there when it happened. And what happened was these two girls, they were at the airport, sat down and started joking about Jewish people, saying that they were going to lure them to the cannibal islands with pieces of challah, and they wanted to burn all Jews at the stake with Kanye West music in the background. And the point that got a lot of people really angry was they started to make a list of Jewish people they wanted to burn. Personally, as number two on said list, it was really disappointing from the school, especially when the school knows who did stuff. They're reluctant to punish people because it's really, really easy to put out statements when you don't know who did something and say, we denounce anti-Semitism, and when we find you, we're going to punish you. But what really happens when they find students is almost nothing. And it's incredibly disappointing to see the schools prioritize the offenders, the anti-Semites in situations, over the victims. And something that specifically Whitman did and Montgomery County is doing in response to a lot of anti-Semitic incidents where they do know who did stuff are restorative justice circles, specifically in instances of anti-Semitism, and especially in this instant, was really not productive. Especially since, you know, Whitman delayed our restorative justice circle until after a Washington Post article was written about the incident. And it was really difficult as one of the kids on the hit list to sit there with, again, fellow students who are also on the hit list and listen to the offenders lie about what they said. And they were extremely unapologetic, and their lawyers are sending me letters now. So it's really disappointing.
Thank you for that, Rachel. Eliana, I wonder if you would be willing to just share with our audience the impact that those three acts and perhaps other acts of anti-Semitism have had on you personally.
Yeah, so personally, obviously, it's just extremely disappointing, and it feels very, it's hard to find the words. I've definitely been doing, as like a representative of a big Jewish club at our school, I've had to do a lot of things where people are like, how do you feel about this? And it's like, I probably feel the same as every other Jewish person in our community. I feel disgusted and I feel unsafe. It's just a very weird experience, because it's not like Jewish students at Whitman. We don't necessarily feel like we're this small group. There's a very, very large Jewish population at our school. So that has been kind of something that is different from experiences at our school than in other areas.
Thanks for that, Eliana. Just one quick question, and then I'll let you go because I know you have to run. But what's your sense of what you think the school should do and the school district should do when these things happen? I guess that partly is just what should the school do generally with all of the students, but if in fact they are able to identify who did it.
Yeah. So that has been like a big question for us. Thankfully, our administration really prioritizes talking to students, which is really great. So we've gotten to have meetings, direct meetings, like with our school principal, with at a school of 2,000 people is really remarkable. And we've gotten to talk to different administration, members of administration, and ask them, you know, like, why isn't more of this happening? If they, like, for example, found out who spray painted the words, I think that person should be arrested, obviously, because of vandalization of school property. And, you know, I think that if that person was a student, that they shouldn't be able to go to Whitman anymore. And but that we saw that with the debate team incident, that it's complicated with like our code of conduct, and it's not just a school issue but a county issue. So I think reviewing like the consequences for people who participate in acts of hate and bias, and not categorizing them the same as bullying and harassment, is a big first step. And then just in helping the students, just being there and being like, just showing that you don't tolerate it is like a big thing. I think that was one of the biggest ways that people got angry, was like, if they're not being suspended or expelled, what kind of message are you sending to everyone else?
Rachel, I want to ask you the same question that I asked Eliana, which is just, you know, speaking from the heart, when you see your name listed as on a hit list, and you personally being called out in that way, how did that affect you emotionally?
Yeah, you know, personally, I started Jews for Change after the incident that Eliana spoke about with the graffiti on our school sign that says Jews Not Welcome. And that kind of put me in the highlight as a Jewish person at school. I got called Super Jew several times. And from doing that, this was not the first time that I had been openly targeted for being Jewish. And it only got worse after I made myself that kind of figure. It's hurtful, but it's not surprising from this debate team situation. I personally was not surprised by this, just because, you know, these two girls had been bullying me for a while, sent emails to the school about it. They didn't really do anything. I will say that no staff member from Whitman ever reached out to me and asked me if I was okay, all these kinds of things. And I think that, you know, Montgomery County, specifically Whitman, has the opportunity here to become a model for the entire country dealing with this issue on how to handle it, and they are losing that opportunity.
Rachel, do you have a sense that the reasons that the administration didn't respond the way you would have hoped in some cases was because they don't care as much as they should, or they don't know what to do, or some combination of those things, or something else?
So, you know, I think that this was earlier on in Whitman's experience with anti-Semitism. It was all the way back in January, only a few weeks after the graffiti, which was the big anti-Semitic incident at Whitman. And they weren't sure how to handle it. And by that point, we weren't treating anti-Semitism the same way that we would other instances of hate against other groups of people, which personally I have always thought to be disgusting, that we are not actually treating Jewish people with the same respect that we would other minorities. And I think that had this been any other group, had we said any other group that we want to burn another minority group, we want to lure them there with one of their cultural foods, those students would have been suspended immediately. We would have had a community letter set out, but because it was Jewish people, it didn't matter as much. And that is something that MCPS and the country as a whole in schools needs to change, because they are not treating acts of anti-Semitism the same as they would acts of hate and bias against any other group. And we need to start treating Jewish people with the same basic respect as we do other people.
Rachel, I know that because you were so angry about the response or the lack of response in your mind, you, as I understand, actually led a student walkout. Can you just describe what led you to do that and what happened?
That was not connected to the debate incident. That was well before the debate. Okay. That was in connection to the graffiti that was on our school. So from there, we organized a walkout under Jews for Change, which was really great. It was very successful.
At 7:30 this morning, Walt Whitman students got up from first period and poured into the commons to protest anti-Semitism in their school. Freshman Rachel Barold and the student group Jews for Change did something about it. For more than an hour, students got an unplanned lesson in the history and impacts of anti-Semitism.
This community will not accept hatred within its walls.
And student leaders like Rachel say this is just the first step. They want Montgomery County Public Schools overall to step up, especially when it comes to the history of hate.
We had over 50% of students in attendance for school that day attend the walkout. And it was fantastic because we had all these students show up. We had our lovely Maryland House District Representative Mark Corman there. We had three rabbis there that our administration allowed in to speak. And we also opened the mic up to Jewish and non-Jewish students so that they could speak about their experience at Whitman.
Thank you for that. And I'm going to let you come back in and respond to some comments from others a little bit later. I want to come to you, Nicole. Again, you're a parent of students in the same district. They're not yet in high school. They're much, much younger. But can you talk about, as you heard about and read about these incidents that occurred in your school district, how that impacted you personally?
So actually, the anti-Semitism within MCPS is something I've been focusing on well before these high-profile incidents that Rachel spoke about. I started to really pay attention, I'd say, in the summer of 2021. And as our listeners may or may not know, May and June 2021, we saw the worst anti-Semitism in the United States and worldwide that we've seen in a very, very long time. The trigger, if you will, was the Israel-Gaza war. But what we saw online, on the streets, in institutions such as schools, was just really scary and really devastating. And at that time, I caught on that MCPS was planning to do an anti-racist audit that did not include Jews, even though Jews face a lot of racism. And it kind of snowballed from there. I started talking to other parents. I got in touch with Rebecca. We've had many meetings with various administrators and teachers, and even students in some cases, just about how MCPS, just again, to Rachel's point, does not seem to emphasize both preventing anti-Semitism and fighting anti-Semitism, and then also celebrating Jewishness in the same way they do for other groups. So as a parent, I feel like it's my responsibility, not just to my own kids, but to all Jewish kids and staff members within MCPS to change the culture.
Mm. Thank you for that, Nicole. And I'll come back to you and ask you to respond after we hear from Dr. Elias about some recommendations he's had and programs that he has helped institute in schools to prevent this kind of thing from happening. And he'll talk a bit about what he thinks should happen when it occurs. And I'd love to hear your thoughts as well as those of others. But let me turn to you, Rebecca, now and talk about it. You are a former teacher and teacher educator. So you've been in the classroom, you've helped prepare teachers. Talk about what you're observing that has occurred here and perhaps elsewhere with regard to anti-Semitism.
So what I have seen over the last few years that I've been doing this work, and I got started at the same time that Nicole kind of began paying attention to what was going on with anti-Semitism, was also the same time for me. Israel was under attack, and what we were seeing in this country was that Jews were being physically attacked for being Jewish. And worse, there was this deafening silence around that violence that was happening. And then in our own school district in Northern Virginia, we had a school board member make anti-Semitic statements in regard to Israel. And a group of parents gathered, and we discovered that there were years of anti-Semitic incidents happening in our schools that were unaddressed by school administrators. And this pattern that I started to get involved in part because I am a history teacher and had worked as a division manager, so I was working kind of in an administrative capacity as well. I started having meetings with curriculum folks, equity departments, school board members to discuss incidents as well as curriculum and policy that may be contributing to these problems as well in schools. And because anti-Semitism just keeps growing, I am now working with families across the DC region, including in Montgomery County, and then nationally as well. But you know, the incidents that Eliana and Rachel described are even just in some ways the tip of the iceberg. You know, Jewish students deal with this kind of normalization of anti-Semitic graffiti throughout the schools that remains up sometimes years on end, even after parent complaints. Holocaust jokes, slurs against Jewish students have just become very normal part of like the daily experience for Jewish students. But when these incidents happen, by and large, school administrators do not name it as anti-Semitism. They seem confused, perplexed. They don't know what to do with it. They will, you know, as reported by the students, not report it to the community, especially if they do know who the perpetrator is. When they don't know the perpetrator, they will do this grand show of calling the police and putting a statement out. But of course, there's nobody really to hold accountable there. So it's a lot easier to take those kinds of steps.
Hey, thank you, Rebecca. I want to turn now to Dr. Maurice Elias, and I alluded to your work earlier about promoting character education. I wonder if, before we get into talking about this topic and how we prevent anti-Semitism and racism and what should be done when it happens, could you just give our listeners a bit of background about your work and about the lab you run at Rutgers?
Yeah, well, you know, our lab has a basic premise about schools, and that is that for 180 days, every child deserves to walk into a school where they feel safe, where they feel supported, where they feel valued, where they feel cared about. And if they do that, those schools will be good places for all kids and for all staff. And not only that, it turns out that academic scores go up fairly dramatically when schools do this. So there is so much that is paradoxical about what we're talking about, in the sense that we know that schools filled with strife are schools that underperform academically. And yet we have people who sometimes think that academics is the only thing that matters in a school. So this is a very, very tricky kind of thing. And in our lab, we basically have developed a number of different approaches that schools can take at different levels to try to make schools the kind of welcoming and inviting and caring place that I was talking about. But this is not a quick fix. You know, the example we just heard is very powerful. I mean, very powerful examples. But think about this, right? What Rachel staged a walkout, lots of kids participated. Rabbis were involved. Legislators were involved. And yet, when the debate team incident occurred, there wasn't an improved response on the part of the school. So these problems run deep. And, you know, just as we're finding out that anti-discrimination training is not a panacea, there's no quick anti-Semitism solution that is going to be a panacea. There's no brief training program that's going to make an incredible difference. It really has to do with everyone believing that there's no place for hate in a school. And until that belief is in place, we're not going to get the kinds of changes that are going to be meaningful. And I think we're seeing, at least, you know, in the work that we've been doing, we're seeing an increasing number of schools that are finally coming around to this message. But you also have people who are afraid. They're afraid of what will happen if they stand up for any subgroup that is victimized. And in this particular case, of course, we're talking about Jews. They worry, what's going to happen if we stand up for this group? But it's not a different dynamic than we've seen with Black students, Brown students, Asian students in different cases, gay students. We're seeing it with trans students. It's all a fear of what will happen if I come out and do the right thing. And, you know, this brings us back to the Holocaust, in essence, and how many people simply went along. And so I think there are two things that are very important that we've been talking about. One is that we have to take active steps to make sure that schools are places that are safe, caring, supportive for every student. And second of all, we have to have the kind of organization that we've been hearing about to bring these issues forward when they happen, because silence is the great aid of hate. And so bringing these issues out and making sure that people who are responsible for taking action take action is essential. Again, these are not quick fixes. In the long run, we have to, for example, be working with the Associations for School Administrators, the American Association for School Administrators, Elementary and Secondary Principals Associations, the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, ASCD. These are organizations that have to get with the program here. because you can't be a school principal and not know what to do when one of your students is threatened with being burned. To not know how to respond to that really is inexcusable as a school administrator. And the criterion I always use is, what if it was your kid's name on the list? Would you be as blasé about it if it was your kid's name on the list? I don't think so. So holding people to the same standard as you would want to have your children or your grandchildren treated is a very powerful and realistic standard that we should expect of our school administrators.
I want to jump ahead and ask a question, and I would love to hear what other people think about how you're going to respond to this. But when these things do happen and they identify, say, members of the debate team that had anti-Semitic remarks that were very hurtful, or any number of other things that where administrators might be able to identify people that committed anti-Semitic acts, what should they do in response to that? There's talk about punishment and suspensions, expulsions, and in some cases these are actual crimes, and of course the police need to be involved in doing in taking appropriate action. But what should school administrators do in your mind when these things happen?
Well, they should follow their rules. I mean, they should follow their rules. There shouldn't be what do we do when this kind of thing happens? At this stage of the game, every single school should have a code of conduct that includes what happens when these events take place. And they should be followed without exception. And it doesn't matter what the subgroup is, what the group is, they should be followed. Now, we have a very decentralized educational system here in the United States. So it is possible that a given school doesn't have a prescribed set of procedures in the face of a hate incident. It's possible. So then they need to develop one, and it needs to be out and clear to the community, and it needs to be very public, and everybody needs to know about it. But I'm willing to bet most schools already have that on their websites.
And I know as part of your work in promoting the development of character in schools, and when it comes to just bullying and other, I mean, we see people treating each other in schools as sort of, we all experienced it ourselves. We saw we've been treated badly by other kids and sometimes by adults. And you are a proponent, I believe, of restorative practices. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and whether you think that could be useful when it comes to anti-Semitism.
Well, I mean, restorative practices have been increasingly used, but they're not easy to use. It's not a matter of just having people go into a circle, and it's not a matter of just having people sort of apologize to each other. Restorative practices is a technical operation that, if not done well, and I think Rachel was implying that this may have happened in her school's context, that not much happened as a result of the restorative circles that the kids were involved with. And unfortunately, the research has shown that these things need to be done well and conscientiously. But here's the bigger point, right? When we talk about restorative practice, the idea is that we are restoring what was there. But when you have a school that is not a caring, helpful, supportive school, it's very hard to have a restorative practice. And so one of the fundamental problems is that if the school continues to be a non-caring school where people can behave harmfully to each other without consequences, then restorative practices are going to fall flat.
You know, I think we often think about these problems in terms of what do we do with the students. But in some cases, if you have adults in the school, educators or administrators that aren't as caring as they should be, that look away when things like this happen, or in some cases just simply don't know what to do, then work has to be done with the adults as well. Isn't that right?
Well, that's where it starts. That's where it starts. I mean, look, you know, kids are not born anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism is a communicable disease that kids catch from adults. And so this is very important. And I think this is, at the end of the day, this is why there are two related but important issues. One is we need to get anti-Semitism out of our schools, but that's not the same as getting anti-Semitism out of the hearts of people. But kids need to have 180 days where they're not victimized in a school, and not victimized on the bus and not victimized on the walk to school. So anything surrounding school is the purview of the school, and the school has a responsibility to make sure those things are safe. But the school will have a very hard time changing the hearts of parents who, for other reasons, want to be determined anti-Semites.
And so just describe one thing that maybe has come out of your lab that schools can do to get hate out of the hearts of parents, or I guess they don't have maybe an opportunity to get hate out of the hearts of parents, but out of the hearts of students, say, when they're coming into school as kindergartners that early.
Well, I mean, the kids coming in that early, I don't think, are harboring any kind of substantial hate. But kids need to have a sense of being welcomed. And how they're welcomed at the beginning of the day it actually determines a lot of how their day goes. That they're welcomed, they're called, they're spoken to by name, they're welcomed, they are called upon equally. I mean, these are the micro things that happen in classrooms that we want to have people attend to, that they are being fair to all kids. So you know, when you've got a large population of kids, of Jewish kids, as there seems to be at Walt Whitman, there's going to be a lot of things that Jewish kids do. You're going to see a lot of Jewish kids in leadership positions. You're going to see Jewish kids getting called on. You're going to see them getting awards. But when there's a smaller minority, that's where the problem is even greater, because a lot of times then you don't see kids getting elevated in any way. And that makes for an even more difficult situation. But what we found, just to give you one example, is that the more we get kids to actually listen to each other's positions in respectful ways, the more we find that kids get drawn closer together. Because one of the things that is true in an anti-Semitic context is that the kids are not really operating out of knowledge. They don't know a lot about Jews or Jewish people. They've heard stereotypes. And when they start interacting with Jewish people and the interactions don't go in the way they thought, kids begin to get cognitive dissonance. They begin to say, they like the same things as I do. How can that be? Right? How can that be? They seem a lot like me. That happens when we have genuine conversation and dialogue. But you know, a lot of times in school, when kids are going to be called on to talk in a circle and like go around and say something in a classroom, all kids do is say what they're ready to say and don't actually have to listen what the rest of kids are saying. When you institute a procedure where kids not only have to say what they want to say, but will have to repeat back what other kids in the class have to say, it seems like a small thing, but it's a very big thing, because it tremendously increases listening. And the more you have that listening, the more you begin to break down the certainty you have in your head about what other people are like.
The writer and journalist Amanda Ripley has a book called High Conflict and how we get trapped in high conflict. And one of the things she has studied for years is this idea of looping, which is doing precisely what you just described. And I'm not sure it's something we really as a teacher myself and a teacher educator, and it's not something that we really taught and promoted in schools, which is how to become a good listener and why it's important. But in one of my recent podcasts around courageous conversations in schools, or actually in several of them, I've asked people to repeat back what they thought they heard. And it's amazing how powerful it is, because it forces them to listen much more carefully. But the people who get to hear someone else describe what they thought they heard are usually very appreciative, and that someone was listening to them and got it right. So I think that is really an essential thing that we could be promoting. And also, you alluded to the concept of dialogue, and I recently interviewed Peter Coleman from Columbia University, who is one of the experts on toxic polarization and written a book about how we get out of it. And he was saying to me in an episode we just published, that the focus in our society really needs to be on dialogue and less on debate. He says debate is about scoring points and winning. Dialogue is about discovery and opening up and trying to understand. And I relate that story because it's probably not a total fluke that this anti-Semitism came from a debate team. Now, I don't want to trash debate activities in schools. I guess they have a place, but the as I remember being in school, the point of being on a debate team is to win, to score points. It's not to try to understand or to say, gee, I just heard someone say something that is causing me to pause and think. I want to know more about that. No, your job is to win the debate at all costs. And so if the debate team was sort of focused on doing that, and you see others as adversaries, and I don't know if that's what might have accounted for their willingness to be have these bigoted comments, but I certainly think, as an educator and as someone who lives in a community where we're trying to bridge our divides, that more focus on dialogue and listening is more likely to cause people to show a sense of empathy and curiosity. So I want to open it up to the others. And Rachel, I want to go back to you and just see what your thoughts are about what Dr. Elias said and his ideas about what might be useful in reducing anti-Semitic acts at a school like yours at Walt Whitman and Montgomery County, and what he said about what should happen when these things do occur.
Yeah, you know, I think that, what are you saying, that kids should have 180 days out of the year where we go to school and we are safe, we are welcomed, is really important, not just for anti-Semitism, but as a whole, you know, we should feel safe in school. Sorry, those are my dogs. But it's key that, you know, just Jewish students feel welcomed, and any way that we can do that, and especially at Whitman, it's a lot easier to feel welcomed as a Jew at Whitman, even though we do have so much anti-Semitism, because in some of my classes, I sit next to Jewish students, I collaborate with Jewish students, I have friends that are Jewish, and he's right, it's easy to see Jewish students in my class. And, you know, he's also right about when you actually put a face to the crime, it's harder to punish it, whether that be, you know, for personal reasons or also just for legal reasons within the school system. They don't want to punish kids. You know, I think that really one of the most important ways to end anti-Semitism in schools is to make Jewish students feel more welcomed. And that was why the first big incident at Whitman, the Jews Not Welcome spray paint, was a big deal, because it did make us feel, for almost one of the first times, like we weren't welcome.
Rachel, just a quick question for you. Do you think there's a way to get non-Jews to feel more welcoming of Jews? Are there anything that schools could do to make that happen?
I think there is. Kind of like what Rebecca said, I slightly disagree. I think Holocaust education, personally, from a student standpoint, is important because knowing our history is really important. Kind of modeling off of the response that MCPS took with, you know, a few years ago when we had huge, huge, huge issues with racism that have vastly subsided since, is they took the stance of educating students on the history of African Americans through slavery, the slave trade, etc. They infused it into our history curriculums. And that was really, really important. And I know personally going through that curriculum and understanding what my fellow peers' ancestors had been through was crucial for me. And I mean, obviously, even before that, I have a wonderful mother who educated me previously on just, you know, maybe we shouldn't hate people on the way they look or things they can't control. But I definitely think that for myself and for a lot of other students, it was impactful to learn that kind of history. And kids are receptive to what they learn in school. I will say that. We are receptive to what we learn in biology, so long as we're not on our phones. We're receptive to the work that we are doing in English. And that kind of work that we, or the education we would receive just from learning the basics of what our people have been through, is important because it's not the same insulting someone when you know all of the issues that they have. It's why we always go off of the basis of, hey, maybe something is going through some, maybe someone is going through something at home. Don't insult them, you know? And once you actually know kind of some of their background, it's harder to insult people or hate them for something that they can't control. If you know the background of their home life, you know the background of what they do outside of school, it's easier to feel compassion for them.
You know, there's a troubling in my mind, a trend that's occurring in this country, which is new legislation in several states that are prohibiting teachers from talking about anything in a way that would cause students to feel discomfort. And it's hard for me to imagine teaching about slavery, the history of slavery, the history and racism in America, or talking about the Holocaust without having students feel a sense of discomfort. And if students didn't feel uncomfortable and that sense of, you know, profound sadness and frustration, maybe even a sense of anger about how these things could have happened, I would worry about those students.
Yeah. You know, I have been lucky to be able to meet with state senators and national senators as well on that kind of legislation and how to block it. Because discomfort is important. If we look back to the Black Lives Matter movement, something that was really, really, really key in getting things going was passing around the video or several videos of several Black men and women being killed by police officers. And that was really, really important to get the movement started, was that discomfort amongst non-Black people, specifically amongst white people, that discomfort of showing them what exactly is happening or what exactly happened in the context of the Holocaust is important. So that kind of discomfort is really, really important to educate people and to get people to want to change things.
Rebecca, let me come to you and have you respond to what you've been hearing so far.
So, you know, someone who taught the Holocaust, slavery, other genocides and you know, horrific moments in history, you know, obviously you can't remove that discomfort, and students do need to be uncomfortable at times when they're dealing with difficult subjects in an appropriate way. And I think it's also important to note too that, you know, when we see kind of freedoms being abridged, that has always been dangerous for the Jewish community. But it's much more complicated and nuanced than just books being banned. As Nicole mentioned, you know, Montgomery County schools and many schools across the country are also adopting a framework that that seeks to explain historical problems and current social problems as being a binary between you know, systems that have oppressed, groups of people that have oppressed, and people who have been oppressed. And the problem with that, and when schools adopt those kind of rigid frameworks for understanding the world around them and also for their curriculum and policy decisions, is that Jews don't fit neatly into the American experience with race. You know, obviously in Nazi Germany, Jews were seen as being, you know, not white. And then, you know, here in this country, we are seen as white, even though we are of, you know, a variety of skin colors and backgrounds as well. And so because we don't fit into that neatly, it becomes very difficult for schools that have adopted that framework to understand the experience of anti-Semitism and have a way to respond to it. And worse, they can in some ways be contributing to it. I, you know, spoke to a parent who said, you know, who shared that, you know, several children that she knew had experienced anti-Semitism regularly in their schools. And when she said, why don't you, you know, bring this to the attention of the school principal, they shared that they did not feel the principal cared because they were perceived as having privilege, because the Jewish community is perceived as being successful. And so that puts us in this position of, you know, of being in the oppressor category. And so these simplistic binaries, you know, from both sides of the political spectrum really put the Jewish community in a bind. And so whenever we see, whether it's from the right or the left, restrictions placed on, you know, freedom of thought and freedom of speech and the ability to question ideas openly like that, Jews tend to wind up getting targeted and first.
Thank you, Rebecca. And Nicole, I want to come back to you and give you a chance to share your thoughts on what you've been hearing.
Yeah, so I wanted to address, I guess, the conversation on restorative justice. Just to be honest, I personally am not a proponent of restorative justice at all. I think if it's going to be used, it should be used in very limited circumstances, and certainly not when it comes to hate and bias and anti-Semitic incidents. I have talked to a lot of parents, and almost universally, it's panned. People do not like it. They do not think that it works. And to me, I kind of see it fueling even more anti-Semitism, because these students are given a signal that if they do something anti-Semitic, they just might have to sit in a restorative circle, but then that's it. They get off, and then they might repeat the behavior again. So I'm really a proponent of in schools doing two things. And again, like we said, this isn't a way to fix everything, but I think it's a start. Is one, certainly education and appropriate education, not just going to the Holocaust Museum, but learning about anti-Semitism now and how it presents today. So for instance, instead of just hearing from a Holocaust survivor, or more likely now a Holocaust survivor's child, talk to a student who goes to George Washington University and has experienced anti-Semitism on campus. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is actual discipline and true zero tolerance discipline. So for instance, if you play a sport or you're on the debate team and you do something anti-Semitic, you need to be removed. You need to be removed from that activity. So that way students will know if they do something anti-Semitic or something else against any other group, it's really going to affect their high school career and even their social career.
You know, I just want to comment real quickly, then go back to Dr. Elias to respond to your concerns about restorative justice. But I just want to say that in my fairly long career as an educator and seeing some of these practices used, what they've done in some cases is to, you know, rather than suspending students for racist or bigoted acts, they had an opportunity to hear from people whose lives were affected by their actions. And in a number of cases that I've witnessed and read about, doing that is far more likely to cause their behavior to change for the better. I know it's a hard thing to swallow when you think that, well, someone just did something hateful and harmful, and now all they have to do is sit in a circle and listen to someone describe what it was like. And I'm not saying that, I mean, there's certainly many acts that deserve the kind of consequences that would come from breaking the law or school rules. But if our goal is to try to reduce these kinds of acts, then having a sense of what impact it had on someone, if someone else is willing to share that, oftentimes, not always, has a profound effect on the person that thought that what they were doing was just funny or just a prank and you're taking it too seriously. And it isn't until they really understand the impact of that do they change. And if all we do is punish, then what some students learn is, well, I guess next time I need to try to make sure that I don't get caught. That's the lesson they learn from that. But it's complicated. And I absolutely understand your concern about holding people accountable. I'm just looking for ways, and I think restorative justice, when done well, can be a way that reduces these things that none of us want to see anymore. But Dr. Elias, you're more of an expert in this than I am. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this.
Well, I think really, Nicole, you're right. If indeed a student is going to be sitting in a circle and listening to something and that's about it, then that's pointless. My colleague at Rutgers, Ann Gregory, is probably the leading researcher on restorative practices in the United States, maybe in worldwide, and she wrote a comprehensive review that basically says that restorative practices are really effective when they're done well, but all too often they're not done well. And the circles are only one part of it. I mean, the restorative practice concept would mean that the kids are having circles in their classrooms in the absence of incidents. And they're having ongoing opportunities to talk about one another and how to treat one another, and things like that. And so when it all comes down to, we don't have a circle until there's a problem, that's not going to be effective. But I think the other thing that Ken said is important, and I think we've been saying it implicitly, and that is that there are various reasons why people do this. And some reasons will respond to some things and some reasons will respond to another. But see, part of my concern, we know punishment is not effective. But punishment is when kids have things happen to them that they had no idea was going to happen. But if a student group knows, and the school knows, that if you treat people in this way, this is going to happen to you. To me, that's not punishment. That's discipline. And so I do think that when anti-Semitic acts or acts of hate are committed in schools, the student body should know very clearly what will happen to you if you do that. And then I think whether there's a restorative practice or not, the consequences need to be delivered. And then there can be other interventions around that, but there absolutely has to be a clear understanding that these kinds of actions are absolutely not permitted in this school. And yet I think what we've all been talking about is that too often adults waver, that they're not committed to following through in an immediate, fair, firm, and consistent way.
Rachel, to your knowledge, are the rules about this kind of behavior clear and explicit, and the consequences for breaking the rules, are they explicit at Whitman and in Montgomery County Public Schools generally?
I would say they are supposed to be specific. You know, obviously, we don't run a perfect school system, but Recently, Whitman held grade-wide town halls going over our code of conduct, as we've had record numbers of incidents occur, not just hate bias, just in general. And it is supposed to be clear. However, if you open the code of conduct for Montgomery County Public High Schools, the section on hate and bias incidents is on the same page as bullying and harassment, and it's quite small. Our administrators and our Montgomery County overlords like to tell us that we are getting equal reactions from everyone, or equal punishments for everyone who commits an anti-Semitic act. But the issue is, that's not happening. Parents should not be hiring lawyers when the school calls them and tells them that their child committed a disgusting act of anti-Semitism. Their initial reaction should be to talk to their child, take their phone, something, not hire a lawyer. It's appalling to me, especially that parents are letting their kids do this. And I think something that MCPS has definitely been trying to do is including parents and home life in the punishment of students, bringing parents in for an in-person meeting with hate bias incidents, etc., trying to encourage parents to talk to students and making sure that, you know, punishment does not stay within school walls. It goes back into the home life. Students are reprimanded by their parents. And that is really, really important, because students have to actually realize the impact of their actions, and parents need to realize the impact of their children's actions.
I appreciate that, what you said so much. And I do want to just say one thing that people listening may say, well, these are pretty serious allegations that have been made about MCPS, the Montgomery County Public Schools, and there are no administrators here to sort of share their perspective on this, and they've been criticized here. And I just want to say that I did invite many of them from the upper administration, school board members, and the principal of your school to participate in this conversation. And I didn't hear back from any of them, and I don't want to imply that says anything one way or the other about their beliefs about this. I have to believe they're being asked all the time by members of the media and others for their opinion on things. And it may be that they've just taken the position that we're not going to talk publicly about this. We're just going to keep this internal. So I just want to acknowledge that they are not able here. They're not part of this conversation. And I was hoping to get a perspective about things like their school policies and whether they think that they're applying them equally and consistently. But I appreciate you sharing all of you sharing your perspectives on what has gone on in that particular school district and elsewhere. So I think with that, we've been running a long time. And as I bring this conversation to a close, I want to thank all of you for being part of it. And for those listening, I hope you will share this episode with others who might find it useful and illuminating, and at least getting people to talk and listen to one another. It's a very complicated set of issues. You can find this on all of our episodes of Courageous Conversations about our schools at schoolconversations.org and on most podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and now on Amazon Music, which we learned recently is going to be featuring our podcast. So we're appreciative of that. So thanks for tuning in, everyone. So long.